This is the Clinical Pharmacology Podcast with Nathan Tuescher, where I discuss clinical pharmacology and pharmacometrics topics from the perspective of drug development scientists. Most drug development activities focus on a single drug product. However, in standard clinical use, patients often receive at least two or more medications at the same time. This is called polypharmacy, and is commonly associated with the potential for adverse health outcomes. In 2022, there was an analysis of the prevalence and factors associated with polypharmacy by Maheen Dallara and co-authors. There's a link to the publication in the show notes. In this analysis, they found that nearly 40% of patients were receiving five or more medications at the same time, and the prevalence was higher in patients 65 years and older. The reason that polypharmacy can be a challenge is that co-administration of multiple medications can cause changes in pharmacokinetic profiles for some or all of the medications. This can lead to potential loss of efficacy or, more importantly, increased probability of an adverse drug effect. Thus, during drug development, we evaluate potential drug-drug interactions using in vitro and in vivo methods. The US FDA has issued three guidance documents on the topic, and the EMA has issued one guideline. The FDA documents cover non-clinical evaluations, clinical evaluations, and therapeutic proteins, while the EMA guideline covers all drug interaction topics. I have placed links to all four documents in the show notes, but I'll only discuss the FDA guidance on clinical drug interaction studies in today's episode. The purpose of the FDA Clinical Drug Interaction Guidance document is to, quote, describe a systematic, risk-based approach for evaluating drug-drug interactions and determining essential information to communicate in labeling, close quote. I will start with a brief overview of the different types of drug interactions, followed by different aspects of clinical drug evaluation studies recommended in the guidance. Then I will review recommendations for both standalone clinical drug interaction studies as well as nested drug interaction studies. And I'll finish with the recommended approaches for interpreting drug interaction study results and how that information is expressed in drug labeling. There are two basic types of drug interactions. The first is when one drug inhibits the metabolism or transport of another drug. The second is when one drug induces or inhibits the production of an enzyme involved in a metabolic pathway. When you have an inhibition interaction, one drug is called the perpetrator, which means the drug that causes the inhibition or metabolism or transport of a second drug. The drug that is impacted is often called the substrate. The first step when evaluating inhibition interactions is to identify if your development candidate drug is expected to be a substrate or a perpetrator. It is possible for the candidate drug to be a substrate for one metabolic enzyme and a perpetrator for a different metabolic enzyme. Similarly, when you want to evaluate the induction interaction, the drug that causes the change in production of the enzyme is called the perpetrator, and the impacted drug is called the substrate. The most common approach for identifying these potential interactions is through non-clinical or in vitro studies. The topic is too broad to cover today, but the available guidance documents provide clear explanations of which experiments to run and how to interpret those results. It is important to identify the potential interactions before you start your clinical drug interaction program to ensure that you only evaluate possible interactions based on experimental data. Drug interaction studies can be prospective or retrospective. Prospective studies are planned and designed to evaluate one or more clinical drug interactions. When you think of a drug interaction study, you're generally thinking about a prospective study. These studies are normally standalone, but can be integrated into larger studies as a pre-specified cohort. Later in this podcast, I'll share some recommendations for study design and data analysis from these studies. But generally, these studies include a control treatment and a test treatment. The control treatment is usually only the substrate, and the test treatment includes administration of both the perpetrator and substrate compounds. Sometimes you may hear the term retrospective drug interaction study. This refers to collecting information from previously conducted studies and mining them for drug interaction information. One example might be mining a previous clinical study to identify concomitant medications taken and then comparing subjects with and without specific concomitant medications. These types of analyses do not contain adequate precision to allow for assessment of drug interaction potential, and they are rarely accepted as support for labeling claims on drug interactions. Drug interactions should utilize something called an index perpetrator or index substrate. Index perpetrators are drugs that have been established through clinical testing to inhibit a specific metabolic or transport enzyme. Index substrates are drugs that have been established through clinical testing to be a sensitive substrate for a specific metabolic or transport enzyme. Thus, if you want to evaluate the potential for your drug to inhibit the cytochrome P450 isozyme 3A4, you should plan on using an index substrate for CYP3A4. And likewise, if you want to evaluate the potential for your drug candidate to be impacted by changes in P-glycoprotein transport, you should plan on using an index perpetrator for PGP. There's a list of index substrates and perpetrators that the FDA maintains that you can use to select the best index drug for your evaluation. Although the index drugs may not be included in the standard of care for your target patient population, the results from a clinical drug interaction study can be extrapolated. If an index drug is not available for the specific interaction that you need, or if there are common medications that you expect to be co-administered with your drug candidate, you may choose to conduct a drug interaction study with a concomitant use drug instead of an index drug. The probability of an interaction between the two compounds should be evaluated first using in vitro methods before conducting the clinical study. In addition, the clinical study should be prospectively designed to generate relevant information that is free from confounding factors if possible. The concomitant use study design is commonly used to evaluate transporter interactions because there are no index drugs for transporters that have yet been identified. The final type of evaluation is an in silico drug interaction study. This involves using computer models of drug interactions instead of prospective clinical studies. Physiologically based pharmacokinetic or PBPK models are an important tool in this area. There are several PBPK models that can estimate the impact of inhibition and induction of specific CYP isoforms. These predictions are used to refine the understanding of drug interactions with weak and moderate inhibitors and inducers when an effect has been confirmed in a study with strong inhibitors or inducers. Additionally, PBPK methods can be employed when the conduct of a clinical drug interaction study is not feasible or ethical. For example, cytotoxic drugs used to treat oncology patients are difficult to include in prospective studies in healthy volunteers. In these cases, using in silico approaches can support and even replace the clinical drug interaction studies. This is an emerging area of research, and there are many drug labels already that include drug interaction statements supported only by PBPK models. I do not think that in silico studies will replace all clinical drug interaction studies, but I do believe that there will be expanded use of in silico technology in the coming years, especially to address drug interactions. I'm going to transition into talking about recommendations related to the design and conduct of clinical drug interaction studies. Most prospective studies are conducted with healthy volunteers. The number of subjects should be sufficient to provide reliable estimates of the magnitude and variability of the drug interaction. As you'll see in the analysis section of the podcast, the two one-sided tests used in bioequivalent studies is also used to estimate the magnitude and variability of drug interactions in prospective studies. Thus, sample size estimators that you would use for bioequivalent studies can be leveraged in many cases to help estimate the sample sizes for drug interaction studies. There are two doses that need to be considered in a drug interaction study. First, the perpetrator drug should be given at a dose to maximize the possibility of an interaction. Thus, the highest safe and feasible dose of the perpetrator should be used. The substrate dose should be selected to allow observation of a possible interaction without exposing subjects to any extreme risks. For example, if you expect the substrate concentrations to rise when the perpetrator is administered, you would select a relatively low dose for the substrate. In contrast, if the substrate concentrations are expected to fall, you may select a higher dose for the substrate. In most clinical drug interaction studies, single dose administration is appropriate for both the substrate and the perpetrator. Multiple dose administration should be done for perpetrators that show time-dependent inhibition or induction. Multiple dose administration for substrates is rare, but may be needed if the compound exhibits time-dependent kinetic properties. The timing of dosing is important for these studies. Drugs should be co-administered at the same time whenever possible to maximize the possibility of an interaction. The absence of detailed dosing information for concomitant medications is one of the primary reasons that retrospective studies are not reliable estimates for drug interactions. Crossover clinical drug interaction studies are preferred because the same subject will receive both treatments. Thus, crossover studies have less variability between treatment groups. However, parallel study designs are acceptable and sometimes required. Examples include drugs with very long half-lives or when an induced enzyme takes a long time to return to normal. Most clinical drug interaction studies are neither blinded nor randomized to treatment. This means that in a crossover study, all subjects can receive the same treatment in each period, and there's no need to blind either the participants or the medical staff to treatments. The primary endpoint for analysis will be the area under the curve, or AUC, and the maximum observed concentration, or Cmax, for the substrate. Adequate PK samples should be taken to estimate both values for the substrate. It is not essential to take rich PK samples for the perpetrator. However, it is common to analyze at least a few samples to confirm exposure of the perpetrator in all subjects. The samples for the AUC should be adequate to permit estimation of the terminal elimination rate constant so that AUC 0 to infinity can be calculated. Sometimes you may want to collect clinical drug interaction data as a sub-study of a separate clinical study. This is called a nested study. If you can design the nested study similar to the standalone study described earlier, you will find that the data will be robust and likely supportive of any labeling claims. If, however, you cannot adhere to the features described earlier for a standalone study and have to use a population pharmacokinetic approach to evaluate clinical drug interactions, here are a few suggestions. First, know the limitations. Population pharmacokinetic approaches can only evaluate the candidate drug as a substrate. It cannot evaluate the candidate drug as a perpetrator. And most times, the results from population PK approaches are informative, but not conclusive, and not adequate alone for labeling. This is because population PK approaches only analyze one drug, the candidate drug, and we can only see changes in the levels of the candidate drug. Thus, we can see increases or decreases in AUC and Cmax in the presence or absence of potential perpetrator medications. Second, the absence of a detectable effect in a population PK analysis is never conclusive. It can mean that there is no observable drug interaction, or it can mean that there was inadequate data or sampling to detect the effect of the drug interaction. However, the presence of a measurable drug interaction in a population PK analysis can be conclusive. If you must use population PK analysis approaches and want to make conclusive labeling claims, first recognize what you're going to be able to claim. The only thing you'll be able to claim is an effect of a drug interaction. But you need to ensure that you collect all the detailed information that you need to make this claim. First, collect the information about the time and the amount of each dose of both the candidate drug and any concomitant medications in the study. You need to collect adequate number of samples at probably multiple time points per subject to reliably estimate parameters. You should collect any information on relevant model covariates, such as demographics and laboratory values. And finally, you should pre-specify your planned analysis approach and decision criteria before you initiate the study. In my experience, drug interactions from population PK analyses are informative for the development team. They can help understand the clinical impact of concomitant medications, allow for simulation of future studies, and help prospectively plan future development activities. They are rarely, if ever, useful for being the only data to support labeling claims about drug interactions. After you collect blood samples and calculate PK exposure parameters from the clinical drug interaction study, you should calculate the relative exposure of the interaction arm compared to the substrate alone arm. It is recommended that you calculate the geometric mean ratio and 90% confidence interval. This is the exact same calculation as performed for bioequivalence. A mean ratio of 1 indicates no change in exposure between test and reference, or no drug interaction. A mean ratio greater than 1 indicates an increase in exposure for the interaction, and a mean ratio less than 1 indicates a decrease in exposure for the interaction. The mean ratio is also called the point estimate, and it is the estimated effect of the drug interaction. So, if a point estimate is 1.45, then exposure increases 45% with the interaction. The 90% confidence intervals are used to define the variability of the point estimate. So if the 90% confidence interval is 1.2 to 1.65, that means that the interaction causes a 20 to 65% increase in the substrate exposure. To interpret these values, a no effect boundary has to be defined. The no effect boundary in a bioequivalent study is 80 to 125%. If the 90% confidence interval is between 80 and 125, then we claim no effect of the formulation, or in other words, bioequivalence of the formulation. Thus, the same bioequivalence boundary, 80 to 125, is the default no effect boundary for clinical drug interaction studies. However, the no effect boundaries for drug interactions can be defined by available clinical efficacy and safety data for the candidate molecule. For example, if you have clinical safety data that is twofold higher than your target, than the exposure from your target clinical dose, you may want to set the no effect boundary to 50 to 200%. Another common range is 70 to 143%, which is plus or minus 30%. If the 90% confidence interval falls entirely within the no effect boundaries, you can claim that there is no clinically significant drug interaction. If not, you will have to state the magnitude of the drug interaction on the label and, if necessary, provide a recommended dose adjustment. Drug interactions are a very important part of drug development. Many adverse drug reactions occur primarily due to polypharmacy, and as we continue to approve new compounds each year, the probability of a drug interaction increases. If you or a loved one is prescribed a medication, I encourage you to read the drug label and ask questions about potential drug interactions of the pharmacist or the physician who prescribed it. And remember, some interactions can come from over-the-counter medications or nutritional supplements. If you experience an adverse drug reaction, write down any concomitant medications you are taking along with the dose and time of administration the best you can remember. That information will be useful for the medical professional that treats you or your loved one. As a drug development expert, you should take care to identify and evaluate potential drug interactions during the development process. Use in vitro evaluations to identify possible interactions, then design and conduct appropriate clinical drug interaction studies. These clinical drug interaction studies are more complicated than they seem, and there are many opportunities to make mistakes. So, review the objectives and procedures in the protocol carefully to make sure you're collecting the right data to allow you to address the primary questions. And finally, explore the use of in silico models to address challenging cases or where you want to extend the results of previous clinical studies to new inhibitors or inducers. For more information, please connect with me on LinkedIn, send me an email to nathan@tushersolutions.com, or sign up for my newsletter at tushersolutions.com/newsletter. The newsletter is a copy of the show notes sent to your email each time an episode is released. Also, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to the show. Thank you.